Morning, Marsha. Will you call the calendar, please?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfeld, Judge Sleater, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Diane Bratfeld presiding.
So good morning, counsel. It's good to see both of you this morning. We have four matters on our calendar today. Three of those are oral. Today's date for the record is January 12, 2022. I see counsel are here for our first oral argument. I'll have the marshal call that case, and then I just have a few additional remarks, and then we'll go ahead with the arguments. So, Marshal, you can call the first case.
Now calling case A210263, Janine Colleen Scott Salchow, now known as Jolene Colleen Farnsworth, versus Kenneth Joe Salchow Jr.
And counsel, I know you've already had your connections checked. You appreciate that we are proceeding today by remote oral argument technology, Zoom. And you know what to do if you were to lose connections with the court. Right now, everyone seems to be firmly in place. This matter is being recorded and the recording will be available. So we ask you to do a couple of things. First of all, please identify yourself for the record clearly and the client you represent before you start. And then second, please keep an eye on the clock. That should be visible on your screen. You know, it tends to go quickly. But we very much look forward to and appreciate you appearing today. Look forward to hearing your arguments. And with that, I think we're ready to proceed. So please go ahead.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the appellant Kenneth Salchow Jr. Appellant is before the court this morning seeking reversal of the award to respondent of $4,050 in permanent spousal maintenance, the award to respondent of $25,000 in need-based attorney's fees, and the award to respondent of $5,000 in conduct-based attorney's fees. The trial court abused its discretion in ordering appellant to pay respondent $4,050 a month in permanent spousal maintenance because the trial court committed error in determining respondent's monthly expenses. This court has held repeatedly that a trial court abuses its discretion by including speculative costs in a determination of a party's reasonable monthly expenses. Here, the trial court committed error by including $1,807 a month for rent slash mortgage and $140 a month for electricity, heat, and gas, where the respondent at the time of the August 2020 trial was not currently paying for housing, having decided to reside with her mother for free, even though she was awarded as of January 2020, $2,327 for housing, which respondent claimed at the time she so sought in December 2019 that she was in dire need of procuring. An appellant was specifically ordered to pay that beginning January 20th, 2020. Moreover, at trial, respondent admitted she likes living with her mother, who was picking up the tab, and there was no evidence in the record as to when, if ever, respondent would begin incurring a housing expense. This is like the situation this court addressed in Rask, where the trial court abused it.
Let me ask you about wife's trial testimony that she waited to secure an apartment until after she knew what her permanent, the amount of her permanent maintenance would be. So there, I think, is an obligation for the party seeking maintenance to show some reasonable certainty in the expenses, not absolute certainty. So is that enough? That testimony by the wife, I read the district court as crediting that testimony.
No, it's not enough by the wife because you had the similar situation in Rask where the
wife Rask said no testimony. There was no evidence.
Well, in Rask,
you might not like this evidence, but the district court credited it, and we're not going to weigh in on a, you know, we're not going to reweigh the evidence.
Well, but in Rask, she testified there was a mortgage expense that she intended to incur in the future when she purchased a home. So there was testimony by the claimant in that case as to what she may incur in the future. Here we have a situation where the wife comes in December 2019 and says, look, This is what I need. I need housing. And she doesn't get housing. And now we're sitting in trial, and she still can't tell you when she would incur such an expense, if ever.
She said it would be after the award. I mean, that was her testimony. So she's gotten the award.
Well, but
is that reasonable certainty that she's going to have to go ahead?
It's not reasonable certainty, because we don't know. She even testified she doesn't even know what she would, you know, kind of housing she would get.
Counsel, the district court credited her documentation on the cost of a one-bedroom rental, and it was narrowed down to a county. I think it was Dakota County.
Right, so, but she also testified that she, you know, was going to look for a house if she got VA certification, so she really didn't know. And all she presented to the court was a printout of three apartments that she found online. She never looked at them. She never narrowed it down. She never submitted anything. I mean, so we don't know on this record when or what she would ever incur. And that is speculation.
Counsel, isn't this often the case with the disadvantaged spouse? Until they know what their cash flow is going to be, it's pretty hard to make a commitment to buying a house, renting a house, and doing anything else, especially when you have other options. And certainly living with her mother doesn't reflect the standard of living in this fairly high asset, or at least income, dissolution.
Your Honor, what I think makes this different is the fact that she goes into court in December 2019 and says, I need housing now. This is what I need. And the trial court awards her funds for that, and she doesn't do it. Okay, she continues to live rent-free with her mother, and she testifies at trial, I like living with my mother. You know, so we don't know, and her mother's picking up the tab. So that's the record before the court. As a corollary to that, and as argued at trial and post-trial by requested amendment, if respondent is to be awarded a sum for housing, then the storage expense of the three storage units for a total of 603 months must be removed from her monthly expenses. When appellant raised this,
husband's expert also recognized in a historical use of storage expenses. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, there's no question that historically, I mean, she was incurring that expense.
So what's the history, counsel? I mean, give me more details. So how long had that expense been incurred?
They sold the home, right?
Not prior to the sale of the home.
Sale of the home, correct. So it's not like
you provided a different number. You know, you're arguing about the storage expenses is limited to the fact that the wife, I think in an affidavit, indicated that if she moved out, if she moved into her apartment or home, a residence, she would no longer need storage expenses.
And she did, right? And she did more than indicate. She said it would be an improper double dip because she wouldn't need that storage space if she had her own place. And that is in accord actually with her trial testimony in that, you know, in her storage facility, she has her clothes. You know, she has some of her sewing equipment. So when you're looking at and her household goods for the kitchen, so there's simply no basis in the record that respondent would need these three storage units when she has her own housing.
I didn't rely on that affidavit for that, right?
Pardon me?
Isn't it wife's affidavit that you're relying on for that?
And also her trial testimony where she doesn't, you know, assert that she, you know, she acknowledges she has this present expense, but the trial court said that she testified that she's going to need this with a one bedroom apartment, and there is no such testimony of record.
All right. So, counsel, would you go on to the Great Lakes student loan? I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay. Also improperly included was a monthly expenses of $314 a month for the Great Lakes student loan.
Because that loan, that debt is was assigned to wife, right?
It was assigned to wife.
And the total amount is somewhere around what, $40,000?
Correct. It's probably less than that because interest has been waived, as I understand it, that's been occurred. But
what happened? Is that in the record, counsel?
No, that's
not. I mean, there's a lot of what you put out to us on the Great Lakes student loan that's not in the record. It's all very interesting, but it's not in the record. I mean, you even asked us to take judicial notice without filing a motion.
So. Well, my understanding, Your Honor, is I did ask the court to take judicial notice, and I can do that without filing a motion. But I think what's important here, Your Honor, is that the parties stipulated in the court by partial judgment entered July 22nd, 2020, states the Great Lakes loan is currently in forbearance until August 2021 and is a combination of two consolidated loans, one of which may be forgiven or partially reduced, though is not yet known as to a certainty. Okay, so that is what the parties stipulated to. There's never been any vacation of that stipulation. Never.
Right. It says that the loan may be forgiven,
Right,
and the district court had all of that evidence in front of the district court and made the decision it did, which his wife is obligated to pay that loan. So,
Your Honor, that's incorrect, because what the trial court did is it looked at a document that the wife submitted, which is dated April 15, 2020, which is months before wife's stipulation in July 2020, that the forbearance is until August 2021. So the trial court was incorrectly ignoring the party stipulation, its own judgment, and the fact that it was in
front of. What I struggle with on that argument, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I just am trying to. I read your what you presented. It's exactly what you're saying now. So if the judge is wrong, you know, to have chosen between these two conflicting statements, the stipulation about how long the forbearance was going to last and the documentary evidence, you're really presenting us with an argument that it's not, that there might be a year's difference, right, on the forbearance. And I'm just struggling with what the impact of that is for this court as a legal error. It seems like a factual dispute about the forbearance that's for the district court to resolve, not one for us.
Well,
so you have to help me out there. The judge had documentary evidence in the record to support the forbearance that the judge then relied on in making.
Right, but the court had a stipulation in its own judgment that the forbearance was currently in forbearance until August 2021. And I know the court doesn't want to take judicial notice, but under the COVID relief now, it's currently May 2022. But also, as part of that stipulation, it talks about the combination of two consolidated loans, one of which may be forgiven. What they're talking about is the Borrower's Defense Program and the Everest loan. So there was a recognition and a stipulation by the parties that wife may never owe anything on that loan or even the 314. And since wife has the burden of proof, it's not made on this record.
Can I ask you, I wanted to shift to a remedy or your client's remedy, requested remedy of the court to, as it relates to spousal maintenance. Because as you're going down the list of items, we, of course, talk rent and mortgage first, and then you referenced the corollary issue of storage, and these numbers get decreasingly less. I guess my question to you is, at what point, for instance, if we disagree on the rent and mortgage and storage, and now we're getting down to the student loan, what's the proper remedy in a scenario like that versus rent and mortgage? I'm from this court. I assume... Are you asking for a remand then at any level for a court to recalculate, or is it simply reversal? And what would be the basis for that?
Well, it would be a reversal in that you would take out those numbers and order the court to enter the spousal maintenance based on that reduced number. is how I see would be the remedy here.
And that would be true even if we get to those smaller numbers. I see the point. Obviously, rent and mortgage is a significant one, and perhaps storage less significant. But we get to some of these other ones, like the student loan, and it seems a little bit less clear in terms of factors, income, and expenses.
Well, it is important because we're talking about permanent spousal maintenance in a set amount. So, I mean, you know, $314 a month, which she may, you know, she can't show that she currently had the obligation to pay, and she may never pay, is substantial when you're factoring it out as a permanent award. This isn't a temporary award.
But it's not nearly the award we had in Rye versus Cook either, is it?
No, but each case is determined on its own facts. And so the fact, I mean, obviously in the Cook case, the numbers were, you know, quite high. But here, given, you know, the fact that, you know, she hasn't met the burden, I mean, the numbers matter. The numbers matter to my client because my client is running a monthly deficit, as the trial court determined, based on awarding to respondent the amount of spousal maintenance. So it is significant to my client.
I have trouble grasping that though, counsel. When I look at a 20-year marriage that generated a you know, net income or gross income for these two people around $24,000 a month, and she's going to end up with her own $3,800 a month plus whatever she gets in maintenance, and he gets the rest, and he's having trouble, and she's not? Seriously?
Well, Your Honor, you're ignoring the substantial marital debt that was involved here. What happened was that the parties had little equity in their home. She had two failed businesses. What they did was they lived on debt, which he ended up having to pick up. So the fact of the matter is while his income is not a bad income, you know, he has the expenses and he has student loans of over $100,000, so which the court cannot discount. So it is based on this record that I asked this court to reverse.
Thank you, counsel. Is there anything else from the panel? And we'd of course have 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. Yeah, okay. All right, with that, we've reset the clock and counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, may it please the court, Ms. Nord Hunt. I'm back to Walt, E-W-A-L-T. Appearing on behalf of respondent, Ms. Janine Farnsworth. I'd just like to note, I appreciate the opportunity to argue against Ms. Nord Hunt today. I've observed her for years and like the opportunity to do so today. With that said, I obviously oppose the position she's taking with regard to the court. And we're asking the court to affirm the district court's orders in full. Both issues of spousal maintenance and attorney's fees are reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. In each case, the district court's rulings should be upheld given they were supported by the facts of the case and were not made in clear error. Regarding appellant's first request of spousal maintenance, as I think the court's already noted, there are four items that are being challenged. The housing expense, storage expense, the retirement contribution, and the loan repayment. With regard to the principal number, which would be the housing expense, I think it is noteworthy when considering the credibility assigned to the district court that respondent set forth an expense of $1,807 per month, which was $1,000 less than appellant's own residence line item expense of $2,895. Given the fact that spousal maintenance, the district court can consider any relevant factor, I think the $1,000 expense more on behalf of appellant is a clear indication of both what the marital standard of living during the course of the marriage was, as well as what appellant viewed a reasonable cost for that expense to be. In addition, I don't believe it's noted anywhere in the record that appellant or respondent did not have home ownership as a part of the standard of living. So to the extent that district court determined the reasonableness of that expense, as well as the credibility assigned to respondent with regard to her testimony of her intention of getting a residence, either a one-bedroom apartment, or I believe the testimony reflected that she would love to be in a home or something of that nature. Certainly believe there is no clear error with regard to that finding. With regard to the argument.
Well, can I inquire about that just a little bit? One of the more, perhaps sympathetic, legally or otherwise, arguments or points made by Ms. Hunt's client is that that was kind of the same statement she made for the temporary maintenance. And then as of trial, she's still with mother. And apparently there's some evidence that she's caring for mother and seems to be having reasons to want to continue to live with mother. Wouldn't you agree? And while we might have some distinctions and arguments about RAS, there is a point, I suspect, where continually to say I'm going to versus actually doing so, when does that play a part for our review of the record? Or is there anything in the record we could otherwise put our really hands on to that something's going to happen with some reasonable degree of certainty such that it makes sense to include that in an expense versus if she said, I have no plans to change and I'm going to live with mother because I'm caring for her. I assume in that case, then it would clearly, and we're somewhere in between that span of no, I'm not versus I am going to move. If you understand my question, it's a little bit of a long question, but.
No, that's no problem at all, Your Honor. I do understand the question, and the demarcation point would be the conclusion of the trial and the legal proceedings. I think it'd be erroneous for this court to assign error with regard to respondents' failure to obtain permanent housing under a temporary award. First of all, temporary awards, by their very nature, are impermanent. Secondly, temporary awards at the district court level, while guided by statutory considerations, are at the court's discretion and hence modifiable even during the pendency of the proceeding. I think the idea that's being put forth that, for example, my client should have signed some sort of a mortgage, obtained long-term housing, or even long-term rental housing based on a temporary award with that uncertainty is simply erroneous. And so when the court's asking where is the demarcation clearly as supported by respondent's testimony, I believe, Your Honor, and I think as noted by this court in its questions, would be at the conclusion of the trial when some sort of certainty with regard to my client's go forward income has been established. And I think that that testimony is reflected in respondents' testimony during trial, Your Honor. And again, just very briefly with regard to RASC, I do believe that the language noted was that there was no evidence in the record concerning when the individual would begin incurring that expense or whether she ever will. I don't believe that's reflective of the trial record in this case, Your Honor. With regard to the issue of the storage expense, I believe that the district court found that respondent had testified that when she obtained a one bedroom apartment, she would still be in need of
counsel. Where's that testimony? I didn't see you cite the transcript in your brief.
I didn't see it in the trial transcript, Your Honor, and that's why I very specifically only noted the district court's finding itself. I did not try the case at the time, and I don't use that as a way to avoid the answer, simply that I don't know where that would be, hence my reflection of the notation where I saw it within the record, which was the district court's own finding. With that said,
you read the transcript, right?
I have read the transcript.
Yeah, and you didn't find it. Yeah. Okay. I'm just asking. Okay.
Thanks. Obviously, Your Honor, no. And I'm certainly not trying to shy away from a difficult.
Well, problem. I mean, the question for us is does that make the district court's determination on storage clearly erroneous?
Right? I would argue, and I appreciate that inquiry, Your Honor, because I don't think it does. First of all, the district court had testimony before it that my client respondent was intending to obtain residence, and she put forth expenses related to one bedroom apartments. To the disagreement of counsel for appellant, in simply noting that the three storage lockers contained, I think, sewing items in my client's clothes, that's simply not reflective of the record. The storage lockers, I believe, contained a number of items, including the property that was awarded to my client, as well as a property that was abandoned by appellant that he no longer wanted, which included kitchen supplies and furniture. So the mere inference, I guess, that we have three storage lockers and respondent is looking at obtaining a one bedroom apartment, it is certainly not clearly erroneous to believe that a storage expense is going to continue to carry forward in that situation.
Well, the district court relies on testimony by the wife, you know, and you described it, that she was going to need storage on an ongoing basis, but that testimony doesn't exist in the record. Isn't it an abuse of discretion for the court to make an award of spousal maintenance based on a finding of need?
If the award was based solely on testimony in that situation, then I would be sympathetic to that point, Your Honor. The district court specifically found, though, as this court's already noted, that appellant's own expert found a storage expense as five of at least 9 months that he analyzed for the party's historical spending. So there is additional evidence. And I would note, Your Honor,
I don't hear Ms. Hunt to be arguing about the amount. You know, what does storage cost? That's not the issue here. The issue is the lack of support in the record for the district basing a spousal maintenance award on this, you know, these findings about storage. And on top of it, we haven't talked about, so what wife's affidavit said that she was not going to need storage after she found her residence. Like you said, I mean, there's some sense given the timing and when they sold the marital home, they separated, the dissolution was later, some sense in the need for storage. The judge seemed to embrace that, certainly in the temporary award. But does that keep going on forever with permanent maintenance? Where the wife's affidavit says, I'm not going to need that storage once I find a residence. I'm going to have to make it, basically, you know, I'm going to have to make a decision. Am I going to use this stuff or aren't I?
Sure. Well, the testimony that's being referred to as part of the temporary submissions that occurred earlier in the proceeding. The fact that those facts had changed or may have changed from that point in time to the point of trial is certainly understandable. At that point in time, respondent certainly could have believed that she would no longer need that. At the time of trial, when she's considering getting a one-bedroom apartment and then trying to move everything that had previously been in a home into a one-bedroom apartment, realistically, that's not going to occur. And so I don't think it's unreasonable, again, for the district court to have found that on a go-forward basis, assuming my client moves into a one-bedroom apartment, that she would continue to have a storage expense. And that, again, would be corroborated by appellant's own expert report, finding that that expense occurred in at least five, if out of 9 months of the spending, historical spending he analyzed.
And you agree with Ms. Hunt that the husband's expert was looking at the storage expense incurred since they sold the marital home, right? I mean, this is not something, some couples do have kind of a permanent storage need. Some families do, but that's not what we had here, right?
Yeah, it was a limited period of time that appellant's expert was reviewing the record, Your Honor, yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Your Honor. With regard to does the court want me to address anything as my time? I'm certainly happy to continue to go forward. I just want to make sure. I know the court had asked questions about the Great Lakes student loan. And if there's something particular the court wants me to address with that, I'm happy to do so. If not, though, the next issue I would talk about, Your Honors, would be the retirement contribution, because I think that is a significant issue with regard to this appeal, given the fact that appellant has claimed that given the fact respondent has not historically contributed much towards her retirement, that she then at the conclusion or as part of a spousal maintenance contribution should be precluded, I guess is the argument, from an award allowing that contribution. I would simply note, as the record reflects, that during the course of the marriage, the parties had consistently applied the maximum retirement contribution towards appellant's income and retirement funding. Certainly, in hindsight, that makes some sense given the fact of his gross income relative to respondents. Secondly, applying that 9% contribution without any additional contribution on respondent, if you apply that to her gross income as found by the district court, would leave her with a contribution annually of $3,766 as a compared to $22,204 for appellant. So as indicated by respondent's expert at the time of trial, simply applying a across the board 9% contribution creates a certain inequality simply because of the gross numbers that we're beginning with. Also, with regard to the point that Thompson v. Thompson would stand for the proposition that if a party doesn't contribute during the course of a marriage to retirement, that they should be precluded from making that claim post-divorce, Thompson simply is dissimilar factually in several important ways to this case. First of all, the party that finding was made against was considered to be the obligor, not the obligee. And so the point of the district court in that case was that because the obligor did not have income available to meet his other expenses and he had not contributed to retirement in the past, that asked expense should not be used as a way to minimize his income available to contribute towards the other party's needs in that case. That's obviously dissimilar to our situation in the sense that here appellant is found to have the ability to meet both his reasonable monthly needs and the monthly expenses attributed to respondent, including the additional $350 a month in retirement contribution, based on solely his base salary and the bonus income attributed to him. So to the extent that Thompson is being cited for the proposition that it should preclude that contribution to my client, simply do not believe that's factually or legally correct.
Mr. Duhall, in your short time left, have you quickly respond to a point Ms. Hunt's client made with regard to the conduct-based fees? And I'm talking about the point, the general point, it might lead to a bit of a deterrence in bringing post-judgment motion for amended findings, which of course, generally we encourage. Can you respond to that argument?
Certainly, Your Honor, and I'll try to be brief. I think there's two points. One is the district court certainly documented the factual basis for the finding of the conduct-based fees, including the fact that the district court found appellant's post-trial requests were clearly contrary to his own trial position, contrary to his own expert reports, and or a clear misstatement of the record of evidence of the court's actual findings. I think two simple examples of that would be very, very plainly the challenge to respondent's need for spousal support in the post-trial submissions and the fact that his own expert had found that need. Both were supported by the trial record and both were challenged on post-trial motion by appellant. Then finally, Your Honor, and I realize I'm out of time, with regard to the concept, I suppose, that's being challenged with regard to 518.14, I would simply note that obviously there's a long history of cases supporting a conduct-based award under 518.14. And to the extent that appellant challenges the authority of the district court to award conduct-based fees, I believe the holding in the order cited by the Minnesota Supreme Court of Anderson v. Anderson actually supports the award with regard to this case, given the fact that the district court specifically found dilatory conduct in the sense of appellant's post-trial motion. I hope that answers the question of the court, Your Honor.
Anything else from the panel? Okay, very good. Thank you so much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So with that, we're ready for rebuttal. Ms. Hunt.
Turning briefly to the storage unit issue, I refer the court to pages 86 and 87 of the transcript. There, the respondent testifies that, you know, it's the household stuff in storage and her clothing. And she says, basically, all my clothing is in storage. And the question was, well, how often do you have to visit the storage unit to trade out clothing? Well, every couple of months. I mean, the idea that if she has housing that she needs storage for clothing makes no sense. And also on the next page of the transcript, page 87, she testifies that she doesn't know at the time of trial whether she's going to get a house or a one bedroom apartment. I mean, that goes to the whole uncertainty in this case. She has VA benefits for housing. So the notion that she's going to get a one bedroom apartment and therefore she needs a storage, she herself recognizes that there is no basis for that. I want to quickly turn to the attorney fee issue. And there's two issues of attorney's fees here. One is the $25,000 in need-based fees, and the other is the $5,000 in conduct-based fees. There is no pot of money that existed by which appellant could pay the $25,000 in need-based fees. The trial court refers to restricted unit income, but there wasn't any. I mean, if you look at the record, the parties stipulate in July of 2020, the marital value of the RSUs was like 4,000 some amount. I mean, there just isn't any.
So counsel, you're skipping over though, the district court made additional findings about the value of the RSU. Let's see, that must be in the order denying the amendments, so the addendum somewhere around 5750.
Right, she's talking about the value of the RSU after the valuation date and after it has been expended by the parties. So the only thing that she brings forward in
that's not in the record, that the RSUs had already been expended. Yes, it is in the record that some of the RSUs have been expended. It's not like he had a, you're right, he didn't have like a pot of RSUs. And that were that's what his employer did at its discretion, compensated him in part with RSUs, right?
Right, but it was discretionary with his employer, and it is responsible.
So not included as part of the income, right? Not for the purposes of determining maintenance.
But respondent had the burden of proof to show at the time of trial that there was this RSU vested income that was in existence by which the appellant could pay. There is nothing of that in the record, nothing. The best
value of the RSUs as of 2/28/20 was 14,000. The value as of December 31st, 2019 was 66,000. So right. Yes, they have to vest for 2 years. I mean, that's true. He's got a series of them, right?
Right. But what the record shows is that as of August 19, 2019, it was 4,000 in RSUs. So we don't.
I just mentioned are all after that time, counsel.
Right. Well, no, because the December is to date, the year to date. So we don't know what was before August of 2019. We just know the value is of August 2019. And again, it is a respondent that has the burden of proof. We do know in 2020 that it was 14,000 minus the taxes, which turns out to be 5,000 something. And we also know from the record that appellant has his own attorney's fees to pay, which he owed on his credit card debt, which he testified to. So he's running a deficit, as the trial court acknowledges, based on his income, which includes his bonus income. So there's absolutely nothing of record that would support an award of $25,000 in attorney's fees. On top of the fact that respondent admitted she used the amount that she got in the temporary award to pay her attorney. So in fact, the appellant has paid the $6,000 plus the $23,000 you know, much more than $25,000. I don't know if I could just briefly address the conduct-based fees.
Sure, go ahead.
With regard to conduct-based fees, I think it's necessary for this court to address whether 518.14 provides a substantive basis for conduct-based fees.
You agree you didn't raise that issue in the district court, right?
That's true. It was not raised in the district court.
And you're relying strictly on this memorandum opinion by the Supreme Court, which, you know, in the brief specifically relies on the dissent by Justice Gilbert.
Well, and also the majority opinion by Justice Lillehog, in the sense that the majority recognizes they've never addressed 518.14. And in Anderson, they had to go over to an inherent authority of the court. Now, respondent here states, well, you know, that's what the trial court did here. Well, no, the trial court did not do that.
Well, the you didn't bring up the issue. So the district court didn't decide that, which is exactly the reason we typically decline to review an issue that's not raised in the district court.
Right.
We have a record for it, counsel.
Right. But you've also, in footnote after footnote, have stated, even though it wasn't raised in the trial court, the court wasn't going to address it on appeal because the parties weren't raising the issue of really the statute allows for conduct-based fees or not. And there has to come a point in time where this court addresses that. And I ask that the court do so. Also, with regard to the conduct-based fees, it's not $5,000 is tethered to nothing. The respondent didn't submit an affidavit that she incurred these fees. I mean, it's just out there in the air. And it's in response to a motion for amended findings, which I would think this court wants to encourage, not discourage. I mean, if the fact you're going to get conduct-based fees because the trial court disagrees with you in part, that's a real problem. And I ask that this court reverse.
Anything else from the panel? Okay. All right. Thanks so much. We really appreciate it from this court. Hearing from both lawyers in this case has been very helpful to us. The matter is now submitted to us for our decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe. So thank you.
Thank you.